We're now halfway through 2026, and geopolitically speaking, it's been one of the most extraordinary years in recent memory. From the US kidnapping Venezuela's leader to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the world has moved at a breakneck speed. So this is a great time for a Q&A podcast looking at the last 6 months and what to expect for the next 6 months. I want to thank everyone who sent us their questions on social media, which we will cover tonight. Here to help in answering your questions is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, yourself. It's good to see you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while. You've not been inviting me.
You're always welcome, Yusuf.
I'm always welcome. I think you've got a replacement. So I want to remind the audience, you can find us on all social media platforms where you can subscribe and you'll never miss a thing. So Adnan, on August 28th, it will be the 6 month anniversary of when US and Israel launched strikes on Iran, and nothing's gone to plan so far for the US. Has the US actually lost the war before it's even started?
It's looking like that. We're going to be 6 months in very soon, and everything America's tried hasn't worked. The assumptions they had, the regime will just roll over. If we decapitate the regime, take out the leader, we've won. That hasn't materialized. And it seems every time America digs its heels in, things just get worse. And we're in a scenario now where America's bases are being attacked. Israel's being attacked. The surrounding countries who rely on American security, they've been attacked. And there's actually very little America can actually do about it. In fact, America's struggling. It's running out of interceptors. Scott Bessent has admitted that they're not going to be able to reopen the Straits of Hormuz. In fact, they're thinking about alternative routes now, underground tunnels and other ways to circumvent the Straits of Hormuz. So this is turning into another Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. And we're only 6 months in. You know, those wars went on for decades. In the case of Afghanistan, went on for two decades. So I think the problem America's got is, what do you do? What do you do in the scenario? You've got into a battle. You can't grind out a victory. And it seems Iran has ballistic missiles and drones that there's very little you can actually do. So you either escalate massively. That's going to require troops. It's going to require way more firepower. That could lead to all sorts of issues. You can try and negotiate, but America's problem in negotiation is they are not in the strongest position. They're going to have to give concessions. And the third option is anything unconventional you can think of. And what's to say that unconventional approach will bring Iran to a heel? So we're in quite a unique scenario. We're in this scenario now where America can't actually win. They're in the war. And a lot of this seems to be now about face saving. It seems to be about how Trump will look. And he's only, what, 2-3 months away from the midterms. And this was the anti-war president. This was the president who was not going to start a new war. And now we know he has started a war. And Marco Rubio admitted that Israel was going to attack and America knew Iran would respond. So they entered the war. So the official version is America intervened because of Israel, which makes things even worse. And that's why you've got discontent in America about this. So I'm not sure how America is going to navigate out of this. We're at a point now where Iran has realized the Straits of Hormuz is their real nuclear weapon. You know, who cares about uranium-enriched nuclear warheads? You've got the Straits of Hormuz. And I'm not sure how America's going to get away with that or even get around it. So that's the dilemma Trump is in. So I'm not sure how they're going to grind out a victory from this. And you're absolutely right. It looks as though another war America might be losing.
So I don't know if this is just myself or other people feel like this as well. I feel like that it was meant to be quick in and out, but it's being dragged out to the point. Now, I don't think personally I follow it that regularly. It's just something going on in the background and just really dragging on. I don't know if that's how you feel. Is that how the viewers feel?
I think even Donald Trump, he's run out of excuses, justification and lies. We've heard talks are going to start 30, 40 times. We've heard the Straits of Hormuz is closed, then it's open, then it's closed. So even Trump now is running out of lies. He's running out of justification. Now, remember, even the Afghan-Iraq wars, we're about to turn a corner. it's a new era, we're on the final straight, and then 20 years later, they were still there. Obviously, with any war, you've got the physical war on the battlefield, then you've got the propaganda war. The problem with the propaganda war is people can see the propaganda doesn't match the ground reality. Iran, you may have killed many members in the regime, is still continuing, it's fighting back, it's able to launch missiles and drones at all American bases. So how are you going to, you know, you can't lie and say they're weak. You can't say they're about to roll over. That is exactly what you said at the beginning, and they haven't rolled over. So I think what happens now is when people see any news item about this issue, it's like, okay, here we go again. It's like people have accepted America's not going to win. So unless America's prepared to drop a nuke or do something really unconventional, it's just another war that America's losing. And even the fact we're talking about America losing another war, this is a superpower. It's supposed to be winning wars, but it's got involved in a war that it can't seem to actually win. So none of this bodes well for America going forward.
So we'll take some questions that we received from social media. The first question, do you believe that Iran already possesses weapon-grade enriched uranium? And do they even have any nuclear warheads?
So there's no official publicly held information where we can definitively say they have. If they have, obviously it's only going to be internal. Now, the things we can look at is you had the nuclear agreement up until 2018, then America left it. And what Iran did was they officially enriched up to about 60%, 60% weapons-grade uranium. And you need 90% enrichment for nuclear weapons purposes. So Iran has shown they've got the centrifuges, they've got the infrastructure that they can increase uranium enrichment. Now, what level they're at, we don't know. There's no officially held information. In fact, the CIA generally say, or American intelligence agencies, they say Iran gets to 60%. And effectively what it's saying is we can go more if we need to, if you force us to. So that's the nuclear enrichment side. The warhead thing's a bit different because you've got your nuclear enrichment. You now need to turn that material into metal, and you need to miniaturize it to get it onto a warhead. And then you've got to make sure all the explosives around it detonate when you need it to. So the only way to do that is to really test it. So even if Iran has done all of this, we wouldn't know until they actually test it. And the moment they test it, then it's obviously confirmation they've got a nuclear weapon. Now, for Iran, that causes a whole host of issues. It means you have a nuclear weapon now. That means the international community will probably get behind Israel. Israel will call for blood. And it seems the Iranian strategy is we can get a nuclear weapon if we need to. We can enrich uranium if we have to. Unless you negotiate with us and give us the terms we need, then that's an option for us. But the moment they test a nuclear weapon, they can't call back to, you know, restrictions on nuclear enrichment. They've actually gone past the red line. And if they go past the red line, that may bring on lots of issues, really, from America. But that will change the balance of power in the region. Israel will feel threatened as well. So the Iranians have always said that our intention isn't to get a nuclear weapon. The whole nuclear process is a bargaining chip. And keep in mind that the 2015 nuclear deal that was made, Iran gave significant concessions and oversight to the West over the nuclear program. You wouldn't do that if your intention is to get a nuclear program. So from their perspective, it seems to be more a negotiation tactic. But that also means if it comes to it and there's no other option, going from 0 to 60% enrichment is much more harder than 60% to 90%. 60% to 90% is largely an infrastructure-related issue, which Iran, we know, has. It has underground bunkers. It's shown it has the capabilities. So beyond that, the only evidence we have is what comes from intelligence agencies. And the thing with intelligence agencies, sometimes what they publicize can be political. So yeah, I can't give you a definitive answer, but we know they do have minimal capability.
So on the topic of balance of power, the US recently made a nuclear agreement with Saudi Arabia. Does this actually now create an imbalance of power? And why has the US actually approached Saudi Arabia on this?
Yeah, so Saudi Arabia has, I think, for about a decade been in on and off talks with America that, look, we want a defense agreement with you. We want you to uphold the regime if it comes to it. And part of that, what they said is that, look, we want to move away from using oil to produce electricity want to use nuclear power. And they said, look, we want to enter an agreement with America. You supply us with the infrastructure, the materials, and the technical knowledge, and we'll contract you. You know, we'll pay you for it. So the talks have been on and off for a while. And now there's obviously an agreement. And agreement, what it was, it's, so it's not for a nuclear weapon. It's for about 5% enrichment of uranium, which can be used to produce electricity. And the agreement they've made is American companies will do the whole process. They'll build the infrastructure. They will man the infrastructure and they will produce it. Now, this deal America gave to Saudi is very different to the deal they got with UAE. With UAE, the material is actually done outside UAE and it will actually be brought in. So in this case with Saudi, all the process is done in Saudi Arabia. So that means in the long term, Saudis could learn the technical process and set up an independent program. So this is a civilian nuclear deal. It's not a deal for a nuclear weapon. So on its own, it doesn't change the balance of power. Doesn't mean tomorrow Saudi will have a nuclear weapon. However, they will have nuclear reactor. They will have nuclear facilities on their soil. So yeah, going forward, potentially they could use that to develop a nuclear weapon, which yes, would have an impact on the region. The Saudis have always said, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, we will have no choice but to develop our own one. Because if Iran's got a nuclear weapon or any country's got a nuclear weapon, the only counter to a nuclear weapon is one of your own. There's no other counter that's been invented. Where a nuclear weapon's coming at you, you've got a defensive mechanism. In many ways, it's like a bullet hitting another bullet. So this is why the nuclear powers restrict the spread of nuclear technology and know-how. But they don't want a nuclear race. They don't want like rogue powers, as they say, gaining nuclear weapons. And in fact, if you look at all the nuclear powers, there was always a political context at the time how it happened. And every power that develops a nuclear weapon got significant help from an existing power. So yeah, this shouldn't change the balance of power. Although, yeah, the Israelis are worried. You know, the Israelis don't want any country in the Middle East, any Muslim country actually, having a nuclear weapon. So, yeah, this is not a weapons program. This is a civilian nuclear program to generate electricity.
So, as part of the agreement with the US, there seems to be some confusion. There was something about Saudi Arabia having to accept the Abraham Accords. That was part of the deal. One of the questions was that was received on social media was, do you think Mohammed bin Salman would actually sign this Abraham Accord and what would it mean for his country?
Yeah, so we've been subject to Donald Trump's U-turns on this already. So this nuclear deal was announced, which was surprised. Well, it was a surprise to everyone, although it's been going on for a while. And when it was announced, the terms of the agreement, what's going to happen, was all announced. Nothing mentioned about Abraham Accords. The next day, then Trump randomly says, oh yeah, and also they have to agree to the Abraham Accords. But by that evening, he had admitted that the Abraham Accord wasn't even discussed as part of the deal. So what happened, I think, is Israel wasn't happy about the deal. So to appease Israel, he's mentioned it. But he's admitted himself, he's admitted that the Abraham Accords wasn't part of the conversation. Now, MBS, for all intents and purposes, he has mentally already signed the Abraham Accords. He has a good relationship with Netanyahu. He wants a good relationship with Israel. And he's admitted he doesn't really care about Palestine. Unfortunately, his people do. So his perspective is, Israel, America, you got to give us something that looks like a Palestinian state because I got to appease my people. Other than that, he doesn't really care. If it was down to him, he said, I wouldn't really care. It's a, you know, it's a territory over here, but my people care. So for MBS, you know, he's in bed with Israel. He's in bed with America. He wants a region where they can work together, they can trade, they share technology. But he needs a some form or shape of a Palestinian state to sell to his people. So that's where MBS is. So in many ways, MBS is being dictated by the public opinion of his own people. Behind the scenes, and in fact, MBS is quite open. You know, he's got a very good relationship with Netanyahu and Trump. He wants to have a more of a relationship with these countries. And he has already signed up really to the Abraham Accords. Although practically that doesn't mean anything yet. He has already agreed to it. He's working with Israel already. So I wouldn't have much hope. I mean, in the end, what a Palestinian state looks like, you know, no one's really defined it. So you could have a really small Palestinian state that practically doesn't mean anything. And he will use that to sell it to the people that, look, we've got a Palestinian state now. So now we're going to trade with Israel. Now we're going to have open relations.
So it seems like a lot of the geopolitical decisions that the US is making is centered around Israel. Do you think this is one of the reasons why it's continuing its war with Iran, despite clear geopolitical losses and, in reality, a lot of other priorities, especially within the US?
I think, look, Israel was one factor, but I think what Trump and some of his cabinet members are trying to do, they're trying to blame it all on Israel. At the end of the day, Israel is a very small country that relies on American finance and military equipment in the region. Without America supporting them, they can't really prosecute this war. So I think there is a decision there by America. There is some agency there that they've made a decision, which is interesting because America's been able to work with Iran. They worked together in Iraq and Afghanistan. Why do you need to go to war with them? But it seems as though they thought by bombing Iran, they will just submit to whatever terms they give them. That obviously hasn't happened. That's why they've got into this problem. And it's a very empire thing to do. Let me just bomb you. We're an ally. We've worked together. Let me bomb you so that you come crawling to me. But that hasn't happened. So now you've got yourself into a problem that didn't exist 6 months ago. And you're right. America's got bigger issues around the world. America's got significant... China's its main global issue it's got to face. But 6 months ago, from the looks of it, they thought this would be over in a week. They thought we'd bomb them, we'd take out their leadership, and whoever's left will come crawling and want to negotiate. And that's when America will say, this is what our terms are. And it hasn't worked out like that. And, you know, I would say, did America need to do this? America and Iran have had a working relationship for a very long time, despite their public portrayal of being enemies. In Iraq and Afghanistan, if you look at the research, if you look at the facts, they were able to work together. That's one thing Israel's never been happy with. Israel's never been happy with Iran and America working together. In fact, as far as Israel's concerned, any cooperation with Iran, it makes them stronger. And Iran is the number one threat for Israel. So what Israel's done to America is forget Iran, forget Turkey, forget Egypt. We are your ally in the region. You support us, we will defend your interests in the region. And obviously Israel has its own interests as well. It would like to see a weak Turkey, a weak Egypt, and a weak Iran. At the moment, Iran's its number one competitor, and it doesn't want it strengthened at all. And when the Republicans come to power, they tend to side with Israel and the Zionists in America. The Democrats seem to find Iran as a power, and they find a way to actually work with them. But yeah, like all empires, it seems like America's got into something that it's going to struggle to get out of.
Final question on the Iran issue. How can the Arab rulers actually make best of this current situation, make best use of Iran and the US war and US's weakening position? Is the Mecca Defense Pact something in that direction?
So yeah, I think we're in quite a unique time here. What's happened here is America and Israel are going to war, and the war is in the Middle East over all these countries that America apparently provides security to. And it's been very clear America can't provide them security. So America is unable to deliver on the promises they've made. So that's why Qatari, UAE, Kuwait, Jordan, they've all been attacked by Iran. And there's nothing much America could do. In fact, what America's done is moved its troops out and it's moved its ships out of harm's way. So all that debt these countries have been buying, all the military equipment they've been buying, in their time of need, America can't protect them. So really, what is the point of that American relationship? America's not unable to... You've always been delivering. You've delivered them cheap oil prices. You developed them military bases, which act as forward bases for America. So this is really a time where they need to... this is the time for them to become independent. Now it should be clear America needs them. America's always needed. America's depended upon their land, upon the bases there, and upon their money that they invest in their countries. So this is the time for them to break free. And the Mecca Accord, the defense pact between Turkey, Pakistan, and Saudi, look, at the moment it's on paper, right? You know, these things, you've got to measure them by, do they actually translate into action? And I don't know, I have some question marks there. If Turkey and Israel go to war, will Pakistan intervene? If Saudi goes to war with Iran, will Pakistan really want to intervene? For Pakistan, a lot of this, they need finance, they need money. the defense pact is their way of getting loans and things like that. Is Pakistan really ready to go to, will Pakistan go to war over a Middle East issue between these countries? I'm not sure they will. So they've entered this pact in the hope they will never have to deliver. If they have to deliver, they're going to have a massive problem. And look, if they go to war against Iran for Saudi, Iran has a border with Pakistan. So the worst thing for Pakistan would be they have to deliver on this, but there is such a desperate financial state. You know, if we're going to provide you security, Saudi and Turkey, they want something in return. It's going to be finance. It's going to be loans. That's what they're going to need. And that's probably what they're hoping. But, you know, if push comes to shove, you're going to have to deliver. And you deliver, it's going to cause even bigger problems. Iran's on your border. If Turkey and Israel go to war, does Pakistan really want to get involved? You know, it's going to be a huge war. And, you know, America's your number one patron. You're really going to go to war with Israel over it? So if that was a real pact, I mean, that would be something else. You've got the three most powerful Muslim countries. You've got financial backing. It's in a strategic location. I mean, really, those three countries together, they will be the regional stroke global superpower. But this is the thing. It's just on paper at the moment. If it gets translated to action, then we're talking. If not, then it's just on paper. And that's the thing to watch. Does it get translated into action? So does Pakistan move troops into these countries? Does it set up bases? Does it give nuclear cover? If it does that, then we're talking. And I'm sure Israel won't be happy with this. This is not good for Israel. All three of these countries are close American allies. Saudi, Turkey, Pakistan. And we were talking that America wants to focus on China. So if you're going to focus on China, you're going to have to reduce your security presence in the region. So what do you do now with countries who rely on you? Well, this is where Pakistan comes in. This is where the allies of America come in. So I suspect it's more in that light, but there's nothing stopping these countries turning it into something much more than it should be. There's nothing stopping it. It's just political will at the end of the day.
On the topic of Israel, the slaughter in Gaza, it would have reached its third anniversary in just shy of a month. Israel seems to be expanding. It's expanding in Syria, Lebanon, and obviously Gaza. Where does this leave the situation now?
Yeah, so what we've seen really since the ceasefire agreement, I mean, there's no ceasefire really. Israel's killed over 1,000 people. You've got the largest concentration of child amputees in the world. There's been no war for the last 100 years where more journalists have been killed, more aid workers have been killed, more UN workers have been killed, more doctors have been killed. You know, they've taken out clinics, they've taken out fetal clinics. They're affecting how many people will be born in this region. So what Israel seems to be doing is this is an opportunity of a lifetime. They've got America's backing, so they're going into Gaza. In fact, they've been very open. We don't care if Hamas disarms or not, we are taking over the whole of Gaza. So this is just a whole play about, you know, Hamas disarming and there being negotiation. Israel hasn't even structured a ceasefire and it doesn't even see America's even criticizing them. Israel at the same time is going to the south of Syria. Israel is going into the south of Lebanon and they are expanding settlements in the West Bank. So for Israel, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. They got American cover to do this. They're continuing with it. So if you remember the last deal that was made, Trump made that ceasefire deal and he talked about having a board for Gaza. They were going to turn it into this new mega smart city. Nothing's really materialized on that front. If anything, Israel is taking over more and more territory. So really, you know, the conclusion really is Israel's continued what it's doing before the ceasefire. It's continued it into the ceasefire and it's actually expanded into other countries. So I will say what Israel is doing is they are creating buffer zones around mainland Israel. And they've made very clear that we have our eyes on Egypt, but more importantly, we have our eyes on Turkey. Because if you think about it, after the first ring of countries, who are the threats? It's Iran and it's Turkey. And at the moment, they're dealing with Iran and they're putting out feelers already that Turkey's on our radar. So for Israel, you know, this is business for them. You know, this has always been their thing that we need to get the countries around us. We need to get them to heal. And then we need to go further and get those countries to heal as well. So for the moment, America seems to criticize them sometimes. It doesn't do anything. It hasn't brought Israel to heal. And I think this is going to cause some tensions in the region. You're already seeing with Lebanon that it doesn't matter if we agree anything with Israel. Israel doesn't stick to it anyway. Israel doesn't stick to the ceasefire in Gaza. It's not sticking to international law when it comes to the West Bank. And in Syria, it's expanding into Syria. In fact, some of the Druze in the south of Syria, they seem to be getting Israeli passports now. So yeah, unfortunately, nothing good to report really from this Gaza war. I mean, we're going to be, we're about 2 months away from the 7th October 3rd anniversary. And the only thing that's really happened is Israel is expanding and we're getting more and more rubble in three different countries now.
We'll come back to the topic of Syria in a second. But just on this point about Israel continuing to expand, where do you see that going? Do you ever see it coming to a stop? What will it actually take to stop Israeli expansion?
So it's quite straightforward. All of this is only possible with America's supply line. If the money, the aid, and more important, the equipment keeps coming, Israel can do it. If America stops it or halts it, they can't do it. Obviously, Israel's created this image that they are doing it. But all of this is only possible because, you know, Israel's not Egypt or Syria. You know, it's not like these countries that have their own industry where they don't rely on foreign money. When you rely on foreign money and equipment, if they stop that out, so that's really the measurement to use. Forget what Trump says. Forget what Biden said. What are they doing? So Biden criticized Netanyahu for a long time for not agreeing to a ceasefire deal, but he never stopped the military transfers that were going on. Trump's done the same thing as well. So really, we should measure them by their actions rather than what they say. Now, I think, look, there must be a red line at some point. There'll be a point where Israel's expanded so much, there's a threat now to the American architecture in the region. What seems to be at the moment is Israel keeps convincing the Americans that, look, we are the best for you in the region. That is, we need expansion for security, right? And look, you know, we're hooked in together. We have the same view of the region as you do, and we will be an arm for you in the region. And obviously, Israel doesn't just do this for America, it does it for itself as well. What Israel wants is once America puts its foot down, they want to have expanded where they can maintain all that land and they'll wait another decade or two where they get another opportunity to do it again. They are still using the events of October 7th to do this. So they keep talking about security. They keep saying Hamas is a threat, even though they've destroyed them. They keep saying Iran's a threat, even though they've taken out their nuclear program twice now. And Syria and Lebanon, they're saying the same thing as well. So that's unfortunately what they're doing. They're able to get away with it. So, you know, the security pact, if it means anything, then they will act on this. The Palestinians are having to take on the Israelis with nothing. They have no weapons whatsoever. You know, is this pact going to do a peacekeeping mission in Gaza to protect the Palestinian people? If it does that, then we're talking. If it doesn't do that, then it just exists on paper.
So Israel, yeah, is continuing to do what it wants to do with the US cover. But as a result of that, we're finding that the public opinion for Israel is going down the drain, ultimately. There was a recent podcast where J.D. Vance, and I think some of our viewers have caught on to this as well, he openly admitted that there is a huge Zionist campaign that's having a massive impact on the American society. And it's really controlling the narrative, especially with the likes of the war in Iran. Do you see that as being true, first of all? Is J.D. Vance actually being honest in that podcast? And if he is being honest, then how is Israel actually achieving that?
So J.D. Vance is being honest because J.D. Vance has been quite consistent. He's a MAGA guy. We've got to put America first, even before Israel. And he was one of the guys, you know, no more wars, no more funding other wars, no more getting involved in wars. And what's happened here is he's probably the only guy on the cabinet who actually wants to deal on Gaza and he wants Israel to stick to it. And, you know, when anyone else says Israeli influence or Zionist influence is a conspiracy, when J.D. Vance is saying it, you can't talk that off. J.D. Vance isn't part of any particular camp per se. I think now, look, there's so much evidence of the lobbying efforts of the pro-Israeli faction in America. I mean, forget conspiracy, it's a fact. The most recognized academics, Mersheimer, they've written about this extensively, that, you know, three factions you basically have. You have one who believe that support for Israel is good for America. So you see this, you know, with AIPAC and these organizations. Then you've got those people who believe that Israel is a forward base for us, so we should support it. So they see the support for Israel is a good foreign policy position to take. Then the third faction you have is the lobbying efforts of the pro-Israelis. You see many, many officials many, many senators, they are literally funded by lobbying money. So these people support Israel, whether knowingly or unknowingly, because that's where their money is coming from. Now, all the three things I mentioned there are established facts. These factions are established, and numerous think tanks, academic organizations have analyzed this, and this is what they've come up with. So it's absolutely true. You find now, Hamas said a week or so ago that they're going to put down their arms. And you've seen the pro-Israelis have gone in, because if Hamas puts its arms down, Israel has no argument for what he's doing. Their whole argument is Hamas is the threat. If Hamas has agreed to put his weapons down, they can't do what they're doing. So what are they saying? They say, no, we can't trust them. They're saying, no, we don't believe them. And what they're doing is they're pushing their supporters to push this in the media in America. You've got to keep in mind that, look, the media, a lot of the big companies, social media companies, many of these guys are ardent Zionists. So they support Israel. They support America supporting Israel. And probably the biggest trend of 2026, it's really the rising trend that's turning against Israel. It's people who can see what Israel's doing. Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, they've really led on this, that look, Israel is a problem. Our funding for Israel is a problem. So this discussion started. At the moment, the money is still going to Israel. The arms are still going to Israel. But what you're seeing is the beginning. This is probably the beginning of the end. Americans are now saying, to quote you, something Mamdani said, we have people in America that can't afford education, they can't afford healthcare, but we have money that we're sending abroad to another country, but they're committing a genocide. You would never have heard this over the last few decades. This is the situation in America, then, and more and more people are saying this. So what J.D. Vance has said is part of a trend, and it doesn't bode well for Israel.
The only thing I would say, coming back to that point, is I do feel that people unfortunately have a short-term memory. Give it a decade or two, are we going to find that people forget how bad this was? Yeah, are people going to forget about that and then go back to, okay, Israel is the only democracy in the area? And they look like us, they talk like us, their values are like us, and actually become pro-Israel again. That's kind of what I see happening.
You're right. I think that's a possibility. I think this is a bit unique. Look, we've never had this before, where the number of people from different walks of life who are coming out, and I think people are seeing what's going on. I think, for a long time, the view in America and mostly West was, look, the Holocaust was bad, so the Jews need their own homeland. And the settlement in Palestine is imperfect. There's a lot of issues with it. But look, it's the best we're going to get. What you're now seeing is people who are not Muslim, people who are not Palestinian, people who are not Jews, they're seeing what's going on. They're saying that, look, this isn't right. The massacre of people, the massacre of children, the massacre of women, Israeli expansion. In fact, what a lot of Americans can see, if they're taught, as Candace Owens said, that the Israelis were the victims. What they're saying is, no, Israel is actually the aggressor, and they've always been the aggressor. So yeah, I still think there's a long way to go for this to like materialize into something where senators think. I mean, what's interesting is you've got Mamdani, the mayor. You've got, was it in Michigan during the week, you had a Democrat guy who was anti-Israel who won. So it'd be interesting, the midterms that are coming up in two months, that is being pro-Israel liability now. Because for a long time, if you were pro-Israel, you were going to make your way to the top. Being anti-Israel was really a career killer, yeah? That looks as though it's possibly changing. So yeah, we'll have to watch how this goes. I mean, I'm not really... I see the Israeli strategy. I see the pro-Israeli strategy. And looking at that, I actually think it's going to go from bad to worse. If you look at the arguments, they've got no new arguments. They're unable to justify what they're doing. I've seen just this week, pro-Israelis use a UN report to justify what they're doing. And when the journalist raises 10 other reports where they criticize Israel, they're trying to avoid answering it.
Yeah, I do think that they don't help themselves. The arrogance definitely comes out. And the more they are interviewed, the more they come on our live streams, I think, definitely people will move against them on that front. I concede that point. Going back to the questions that we got from social media, completely different topic. What are the implications of the shift from a unipolar world order to a multipolar world order? And what does that actually mean for the world?
So, yes, quite significant if the shift does take place. So unipolar order is where you have one power, America, who is a superpower by far. So they get to set the terms of the world, you know, the system, they dominate it. What happens in a system like that is it's very difficult for an independent power to emerge. And everyone really is restricted by this order. So if you look at America, they use international law, they use the UN to achieve their goals. What happens in a multipolar order is where you have multiple nations. So that now means no one nation has ultimate control over the world. And most of human history, what you find is always been multiple powers, more than one. So the last 30 years have been quite unique. Even during the Cold War, you had two powers. You had a bipolar order. What you had is then America, unipolar order, and looks like they've messed it up themselves, to be honest with you. It's not like there's another power that's trying to push them off. But because they've trampled over everything they've promoted, now what's happened is people have completely lost confidence in America. People have lost confidence in what they stand for. So in a multipolar order, it's going to be difficult for America to dictate everything, because as a nation now, you have options. You can turn to other countries to help you, which will strengthen them and weaken America. So I think the key thing with this question is we are shifting to a multipolar order because the unipolar power has messed it up. And it messed up with Iraq and Afghanistan. But you see now with Iran, they can't even win a war. So this is quite, you know, these are all very, very unique moments that we're monitoring. I mean, we are literally watching the decline of a superpower in lifetime. If you're around in the early 2000s when the century started, people would have laughed at you if you mentioned America declining this century. In fact, the talk was of the 21st century being the American century. And here we are, two wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Iran. And probably more importantly, America's trampled over every value it believed in: freedom of speech, freedom to protest, democracy. I mean, you've had rigged elections in America, according to Trump. That's the scenario we're in. So, multipolar order, it means countries can break free. It means there are options to stand up against the superpower. So that's the worst thing for America. If you're the unipolar power, you dictate the terms of the world. So it's the worst thing for the unipolar power is where global power now shifts to multiple powers. And that now means they're going to have to negotiate and they will not always get their terms. So whatever the agreement is with Iran at the end, there's a very good chance America will have to give some concessions if it wants to come out in any good shape on the other side of this.
Now, just on the topic of American decline, I was reading recently how this has actually given Britain some opportunities to grow its presence on the global stage, because America has kind of pulled out from certain areas. Is that actually true? Are we seeing a resurgence in British power?
So sort of bad news for anyone who's in the UK. I don't see any resurgence. Even if America's weakening, I don't see Britain replacing America or Britain going into places where America's retreating. Britain has its own domestic issues. I mean, Britain can't even afford its military. It can't really go out alone. In fact, both France and Britain, I think they're on their way down the league table of nations. And I think even with America, I don't think Britain has the economic or military capability to take advantage of what's happened to America. Maybe China does, if it takes up the opportunity. I can't see Britain doing it. Britain lacks the finance, lacks the budget, lacks the military, lacks the industry. So I don't think Britain is in the position really to take advantage of this. Places like China are, or if a couple of other countries come together and join together. So look, there's nothing stopping Turkey, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia taking advantage of this. If they have the political will, this is an opportunity. You've got the nukes of Pakistan. You've got the military capabilities of Pakistan and Turkey. You've got the economic strength of Turkey. And then you've got the oil wealth of Saudi Arabia. Really, that should be a superpower. But that's if politically they use it like that. And this is what happens when the global power changes. it now means that there is bandwidth for other nations to step in there. So it's an opportunity for countries if they can take advantage of it.
What do you make of Germany?
So Germany, I don't think there's too much good to say. Germany has its own domestic issues. I mean, the biggest problem Germany's got is they destroyed themselves by cutting their energy relationship with Russia. I mean, I still can't believe they agreed or they did nothing about the bombing of the Nord Stream line. You've got to remember that Germany, 50% of Germany is industry and 50% of what they produce gets exported. And all of that requires energy, it requires gas, it requires oil. And the cheapest and the resource that they were getting in large volumes was from Russia. And they've completely destroyed that. And you're seeing this already. Volkswagen are virtually bankrupt. They're going to become a military company now. And already German companies are saying they can't compete with China. They can't compete with their battery technology and the number of vehicles they're producing. So Germany has a massive problem now. And that's why it's not surprising the right wing are surging in Germany, because the proper politicians you've got are completely destroyed the country's economic model. So unless they find a new economic model, or unless they develop a relationship with Russia again, I can't see Germany stepping in areas where America's retreating.
So be honest, Adnan, have you got a Chinese car yet?
I haven't yet. I have a Japanese car, haven't got to a Chinese one yet.
I'm sure it'll be soon enough. So another question on Germany. Obviously, the alternative for Germany, they are getting a lot more support. What do you think are the chances of them coming into power? And where do you think they will take Germany in terms of their foreign policy and Europe as a whole?
So yeah, the AfD, Alternative for Germany, they've been resurging for a while now because there's been discontent in Germany. And I think that's a trend across Europe. People are moving to the right because they've just lost confidence in mainstream politicians. So at the last election last year, the AfD actually got 20% of the total vote. They came second to the winning party. And previously, they've picked up significant votes as well. So they've been doing well. And I think this year, Germany is a federal state. So you have elections at a federal level, and then you have the national elections. At a federal level, they've generally done well in East Germany. So this was the area that was under communism and it's needed a lot of development. But this year they won in the northern area of Germany, which is very, very significant. But I think there's quite a lot of hurdles they're going to have to overcome. First thing with Germany is the system, the elections are based on proportional representation. So your final seats in the parliament are based upon the proportion of seats you win. And that's based upon the proportion of the total vote you get. So it's not first past the post like we have in the UK. So that's why in Germany, you always have two-party or three-party coalitions. In Germany's post-war history, there's only been one time in the early 50s where someone won a supermajority. They got 51% of the vote. That's never happened. And already the German parties, they've got a rule that they refuse to work or go in coalition with right-wing parties. So that doesn't bode well for them, because the Alternative for Germany may pick up a lot of votes, but for them to get a majority seems really, really far-fetched. I mean, they'd have to get 51% of the total vote. Of the total vote. That, you know, no one's done that in German history apart from that one time and for one term only. I think what the AfD represents is people have had enough of mainstream politicians. Mainstream politicians talk the talk, they don't deliver. They've not delivered for the people. And that's why in Holland, in Germany, in the UK, the right wing are doing well. And that's why the AfD have done well. Now, the AfD want to have a good relationship with they want to have a good relationship with Russia. They want to get Russian energy. They've been critical of NATO. They've been critical of their relationship with America. They believe they should be a nation that has a relationship with America, but they feel at the moment they're like a vassal of America. And they want to have a looser relationship with the European Union. They don't want Germany to leave the European Union and integrate. What they want is the EU is a loose coalition of nations, and Germany is one of them as well. So if they do win the election, it is quite significant. But we've seen this before. Right-wing parties, they tend to water down their policies once they get into power. And the other thing, AfD, like all the right-wing parties, they're all anti-immigration. They're talking about remigration. And that's popular with people. because the right-wing parties are blaming everything on immigration. And remember, Germany has been in population decline since the 1960s. So that's really the issue. They're not having enough children. So I don't think the AfD will take power. The other parties are already saying they will never enter into a coalition with them. So there is a scenario. The AfD gets more votes than everybody else, but they still can't form the government. If three or four parties come together, they will form a majority. Now, it's possible, though. I mean, the next election is not until 2029. If the AfD comes second regularly, then people in Germany might vote for them, thinking these guys have the prospects to come to power. So that's possible as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces and a lot of things have to come together for the AfD to take power.
A couple of questions on South Asia. Pakistan, it seems to be on war on all its fronts. There's a lot of discontent in Kashmir. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so Pakistan-held Kashmir is supposed to be a self-governing area. So Islamabad, Pakistan, managed the foreign policy, managed the overall economy. But Pakistan-held Kashmir has its own parliament, has its own leader, has its own political parties. What Pakistan's always done is it's always had 12 seats that it controls. So there's about 56 seats in the parliament. So 12 seats is quite significant. It determines who gets to power or not. What's happened now is Kashmiris are saying that these seats, officially, these are Kashmiris who don't live in Kashmir. That's what Pakistan's always argued. So what's happened recently, there's been protests about this. So officially, the Kashmiris are saying we want more power. So these are the Kashmiris Pakistan's always said, these are our people. We have to join this land with Pakistan. They've allowed them to self-govern for the moment. But what's happened now, you've got a new generation of Kashmiris, you've got a lot of Gen Zs, you've got Gen Xs. You know, they've seen for a lot of this policy. And what actually led to the recent tensions was really flour and energy prices, economics again, which seems to be a trend across the board. And Pakistan just used heavy-handed tactics to deal with it. They cut the internet. And we were coming up to elections, so what Pakistan did, they cut the internet and then sent in the armed forces who were very, very heavy-handed. And this is why things are blown out of proportion. So Pakistan is technically at war in Kashmir, is at war with the Taliban, is entered into a defense pact with Turkey and Saudi, which is largely about Iran. So Pakistan's fighting on all fronts. You know, for a country that's got significant domestic economic issues, it's probably the worst position to be in. And I would say, again, the Kashmir issue is stuff they are making. It's the way they've treated the people, very heavy-handed. And, you know, you get heavy-handed, people are going to turn even more against you. So India must be licking its lips. You know, Pakistan has always said, this part of Kashmir is ours. These are our people. And this is how you treat them. So India must be having a field day, really.
If we go over to Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, she's recently made an address in India saying that she wants to return to Bangladesh in December. That would be 2 years since she was deposed. How are things in Bangladesh now? What's the situation like?
Yeah, so yeah, it's been 2 years. 2 years, literally this month, August.
I've got to give it to her. She's confident to go back to Bangladesh.
Yeah, so I think what's going on here is Sheikh Hasina and her family led it to India. And some other Awami League seniors managed to get out and come to Europe. But many Awami League supporters have been targeted. They've lost their jobs. Some of them have been pulled up in front of court. So there's a feeling amongst a lot of Awami League stalwarts that they are living at large in India whilst we're suffering. So I think she had to do is to show her supporters that, look, I'm here. I'm still thinking about you. So the Indian government has said there's nothing to do. As far as they can, this is a private matter. She's given a speech. So the new Bangladeshi government, they are saying, oh, India's backing this. And India's saying, there's got nothing to do about this. This is a private thing she's doing. We're not even related to it. Yeah, so I think this is more for her supporters that, look, you know, I remember you. I mean, if she's got her head screwed on, she ain't coming back in December. You know, you were, I mean, she was given a death sentence in absentia. That's what's happened, yeah? But look, you know, South Asian politics, yeah? You know, when you're down, you're never down. You can always come back. Nawaz Sharif, I think, the champion, come back 3 times. In India, the Congress Party have lost power so many times they managed to come back. And I think Bangladesh's history has been 2 parties in power. So, yeah, she's probably playing what all these guys do. You know, you've got to bide your time. And also, look, we've been 2 years. You know, the economic situation hasn't necessarily improved in Bangladesh. You've had Tariq Ramadan. I mean, the elections were just this year. You've had elections after 2 years. Tiger Oman won it. He's managed to maintain relations with China. They are trying to develop a new relationship with Pakistan. So economically, they're going to be dependent upon China and Pakistan, really, because Sheikh Hasina and the Awami League were close to India, and India wasn't happy of what happened. But I suspect if the economic situation doesn't improve, then this government will start to have problems. And again, you know, Tariq Rahman is a bit of an unknown quantity. He was in the UK for most of the 2000s, and he hasn't come across as, you know, a political animal. It seems, you know, he's trying to keep all parties happy, yeah? And he's not really been challenged yet. But I would suspect the economic situation doesn't change, he's going to have massive problems. But yeah, from Sheikh Hasina, you know, from a purely neutral perspective, this makes sense. You know, where you've been for 2 years, you've been living at large in India, you've got to get a message out. And effectively, I think this message is to a supporter that, look, I'm coming back in December, I'm still around, I can see your plight, I haven't forgotten you. So from that sense, it makes sense for her to do it. Can she translate into action? Well, we'll have to wait and see in December. But I think it would be a disaster if she decides to come. It would be a one-way ticket to prison.
100%, 100%. Will China invade Taiwan? I know this is a question we've discussed many times. Is it going to happen?
So not at the moment. I understand the context here with America busy in the Middle East, with America always saying China's our number one option. Wouldn't this be the right time? Yes, I think it would be the right time. The only problem is, you know, Sun Tzu says, you know, when your enemy's making a mistake here, let him make the mistake. If China invades Taiwan, this is exactly the reason America needs to increase its military, move its military to the other side of the world. At the moment, remember, the conversation is, why are we involved in this war in Iran? How many troops have died in Iran? If China invades Taiwan, that is a justification. We need to mobilize the military. But I think also, look, you know, Taiwan, you've got to remember, it's economically integrated into China. Most of its exports go to China. Does China really need to go to war? Economically, it's integrated. The only problem they're going to have is the Taiwanese people just don't see themselves being part of China. Culturally, they find themselves to be different. So the way China should deal with that is culturally. It needs to deal with soft power, but this is the last thing China has. So yeah, I don't think Xi Jinping is sitting there thinking, America's got bogged down in the Middle East. This is an opportunity for me. What China's doing, it does drills. It reminds Taiwan that, look, we can take you over anytime we want. It constantly does these drills. I think even these drills have been done with North Korea. And I think that seems to be their strategy at the moment. Keep in mind, you know, China only gets one chance at this. You mess this up, it's over. America will expand its military to the other side of the world. So really what you want is, if America's bogged down, let them get bogged. In fact, what they should do is support Iran. Arm Iran so America gets more and more bogged down. But it's possible, if America comes out this weakened, Taiwan might just go to Beijing anyway, knowing that with America weakened, our security is gone. And the Gulf states who have had security from America much longer than Taiwan, if America can't defend them, how is America going to defend Taiwan? So Taiwan might realize maybe it's time to go to... And Taiwan, as far as China's concerned, is a rebel province. And because they keep talking about their independence, that's a problem. If they stop saying they're independent, if they start saying to China, look, let us remain autonomous, but we won't be linked to the West. Not like Ukraine's doing, yeah? That's fine with China. Well, China doesn't want Taiwan to be the Israel of the Far East. That's the fundamental issue. And they see it as a slur on their name. There's one party for China, the Communist Party. And China is all of mainland China and Taiwan. So that's been their issue. And, you know, in many ways, Ukraine's learned the hard way of what happens if you want to be with the West. You know, we're coming up to 3 years of war now. Does Taiwan really want that? So yeah, I can't see them doing it at the moment. And in many ways, the longer this goes on, really, you know, if you're sitting there as a Taiwanese leader, if America can't protect the Gulf countries, how's it going to protect you?
AI. Will AI define the next superpower? I mean, it's going crazy.
Yeah, it probably will. Technology and power has always been linked. You look at the Industrial Revolution, what it did to Britain, the generation of electricity, the internet and the personal computer, look what it did to America. Technology has always been a key factor when it comes to power. So we are really at the early days of AI yet. We're seeing AI being incorporated into the military. And, you know, where you can make decisions at a split second, that can be done now. So the exactly how AI will be used, I think it's still going to play out yet. But you're seeing China and America battle it out. You're seeing different regulation emerging in the East compared to the West. So, you know, whoever manages to dominate this area potentially will be the power. And the important thing here really is technology and geopolitical power go hand in hand. Every power we've had in history was also the foremost innovator of the era. So you look at the European colonialists, you go further back, look at the Chinese, you look at where we are now, you look at the Cold War between America and the Soviet Union. Technology, technological advancement and innovation is central actually to power. And this is the great power competition we're seeing play out currently.
Will Trump lose both houses in the midterms? And what does recent Muslim successes tell us?
So I think Trump or the Republicans will definitely lose the House of Representatives. All, I think, was it 600 plus seats are up for grabs. The Senate is a bit different because although there's 100 members of the Senate, only a third every 2 years are up for grabs. So I think the Senate looks a bit more difficult. The House of Representatives probably will lose, which is important. I mean, the equivalent is losing the House of Lords, but you still dominate Parliament. You know, the House of Lords still has to sign off for all the laws. But what this midterms is turning into a referendum on Trump. And that's what's most significant here. So that would mean that his last 2 years, he will be a lame duck. How's he going to pass laws? I'm sure he'll try and find a way to do it. I think Trump can see this coming. You know, well, unless he believes on lies, you know, you're going to war. The war's not gone well. The economy hasn't improved. And you know how much you're going to lie. And people can see this. And this is why anti-Trump senators are doing well. Anti-Israel or anti-Zionist senators are doing well. And that's why you've seen success in Michigan, in some of these areas. And in fact, there's a whole chunk of Democrat base who've completely turned against Israel, completely turned against the American empire. So I think things are changing. I mean, even if Trump managed to hold on, I think the underlying trends are for change. What you've effectively got is you've got the elites of America who believe in the American empire. They believe that America, the taxpayers, should support them. You've got the American public who are questioning, how did the empire serve me? How did the empire benefit me? It doesn't. I can't afford healthcare. I can't afford to send my son or daughter to college, but we're spending money on 1,000 bases abroad. And this is usually the beginning of the end of all empires. So what you've got is the masses don't want or care about the empire. A tiny minute of people at the top of the pyramid, the empire serves them. So the fact that this wasn't even a conversation 10, 20 years ago shows you how far we've actually come. So the Muslims getting on, the anti-Trump and anti-Israel individuals doing well, it's confirmation of this trend.
Final question for you, Adnan. Again, on America, it's hard to really find anything positive about the US currently. Where would you say the US stands as a global superpower?
Well, there's very little good to talk about because just look what America's doing. We are on the back of two wars, which they didn't win, and those countries are in worse position today than when they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. And the relationship with Israel has been completely exposed. You're seeing, you know, every value America believed in being trampled over one by one. You name it, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom to protest, all going out the window. We now know the ban of TikTok has nothing to do with Chinese security. The ban of TikTok was because Israel wasn't happy about this one platform not being under American or Zionist control. Right? You've got laws being passed in America that if you want to come to America on a visa and you criticize Israel, you won't be given a visa. At the same time, you have laws being passed. If you restrict the free speech of an American anywhere in the world, you won't be given a visa. These are contradictory laws. So the main thing of America is everything you promoted to the world, global liberal order, international law, democracy, freedom, and a better economic life, all of these you've trampled upon. And you've got Trump now. I mean, you never hear Trump refer to a value, an American value or Western values. Obama couldn't keep his mouth shut about values and the founding fathers. This is where the empire is now. empire now is all about damage control. How do we make sure the empire continues? And the way the empire continues is Saudi, Germany, Italy, South Korea, you got to pay us for your security. Saudi, UAE, Qatar, oh, we know we were supposed to defend you, but you got to pick up your weight now. So we're in a situation where the empire cannot afford all its obligations. Everything that made America strong, now America can't afford it. So now America's abandoning the global liberal order. America's abandoning free trade. So this is why everyone's really negative. And in fact, the Americans, according to survey after survey, are the most negative about America's position around the world. So this is where we are. We started the 2000s with America expanding its empire. And we are now at a position where the world doesn't want the empire, never has wanted it for long. And the Americans are now questioning the empire. And these things don't end well. You know, just to finish with an example, the Soviet Union went through a similar scenario. They'd had enough of the USSR, had to serve the Russian people. Russia first, sounds very similar to America first. The Soviets got out of the Afghan war. Trump got America out of the Afghan war. Trump is saying we need to put America first. That's exactly what the Soviets did. 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. The East German Republic, the most important republic in the USSR, said we're out. 2 years later, the Soviet Union was gone, completely dissolved. That's what happened then. And we're seeing a similar thing play out with America now.
I said final question. What do you think is America's Berlin Wall?
Well, we could do a whole podcast on that. So there are many things that could be America's Berlin Wall. It could be Israel. It could be a ruler's overthrown in the Middle East and America can't come and defend it because it's got other priorities. I actually thought Trump would lose the election. He refused to accept the result and you get civil war in America. Unfortunately, Kamala Harris did such a bad job. He won the swing states and he won by a landslide victory. So he put off a civil war for a while. I think America's Berlin Wall will probably be something happens in the world and America can no longer do anything about it, or America decides it's not as important to the domestic issue we got. Because that then tells us America's not the power it used to be. That confirms America cannot do what it was doing 10 years ago. When the Berlin Wall came down, everybody expected the Red Army will get sent in, which is what they did. They went to Czechoslovakia, they went into Hungary, and they put the protest down. Gorbachev made the decision, we got bigger problems going on. So what that said was that they are not the power anymore. I mean, you know, East German Republic wasn't any old republic. So if the Egyptian rulers overthrown, if the Pakistan leaders overthrown, and we've had this already, if you look, America can't protect the Gulf states against Iran. The post-war order was based on the petrodollar, where Saudi and the Gulf countries priced their oil in dollars, and they used those dollars to buy American military equipment, American debt, and in return, America will provide them with security. That's been completely blown. If I was Saudi or any Gulf country, all that money we put in America, and at our time of need, you can't even defend us. It's exposed America. So this may very well actually be the Berlin Wall moment. In fact, there are so many things that could be the Berlin Wall moment for America. It depends on which one it will be. At the time the Soviet Union come down, everybody believed, look, as bad as the Soviet Union, it's too big to fail. It's too big to completely disappear. And it happened in a couple of years in the end. So I don't think America will disappear. I think what will happen is America just won't engage globally anymore because it's got bigger issues at home, which in many ways is what happened to Britain. You know, the two world wars, it bankrupted Britain, so Britain could no longer engage in the world. What Britain did was it engaged more domestically and it just sits at the table. So I'm sure we're going to return to this question because it's probably going to come up again and again. So it probably needs its own podcast, but definitely something to watch. It's definitely something we're watching at the GOP. But look, it's not every day a superpower declines. It's not every day the global power changes. And that's what makes it significant.
Definitely. Thank you for your time today, Adnan. To the audience, if you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.